This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hello, and welcome to Critics at Large, a podcast from The New Yorker. I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
And I'm Vincent Cunningham. We three are staff writers at The New Yorker, and each week on this show, we make sense of what's happening in the culture right now and how we got here. This week, guys, I have music on my mind.
Interesting.
It might be because of the Grammys. It might be because of the Super Bowl halftime show by Usher Raymond, one of my childhood heroes.
Yes.
And maybe, it's just because I'm in the middle of making a new playlist on Spotify, and it's kind of kicking my ass. I'm stuck.
What's the first song?
Ooh, the first song is Water by Tyla.
Oh, you love that song.
I love that song.
The first time I heard the song was you singing it. It was very early on in the song's journey. Now we all know and love this huge hit, but
The definition of word of mouth.
Yeah.
But I also just recently saw this Bob Marley biopic that's just out. It's called Bob Marley, One Love, and it tells a sort of slice of life story of Bob Marley planning a concert in the middle of a sort of moment of political strife in Jamaica, political violence between the two major parties there, and Bob sort of as this symbol of freedom and hope in the middle of it.
It's a hit.
Reggae is the people music.
You know you're a superstar.
I am a superstar. You can't separate the music and the message. You see, reggae music come to unify the people.
Not everyone likes what you're saying. For your own safety, you need to stop.
Nomi, I know you saw this movie.
I did see this movie.
What did you think about this movie?
I did not like it, Vincent.
Neither did I. Can you tell me a little, the tiniest bit about why you did not like it?
Yeah, we'll go into this in more detail, I think, in a moment. But I just thought it was a pale rehashing, almost abstract, I would say.
Yeah.
Kind of like rushing through the motions of a period in Bob Marley's life that sounds extremely interesting, but it was just so kind of like cliche ridden and non-specific to me that I was, you know, I do have to admit I even fell into a sweet slumber for about 10 minutes in there. I did watch the movie, not to say I am qualified to speak on it. I just...
You sound qualified to speak on it. And if
I'd say if it was only 10 minutes of a nap, of course you're
it
qualified.
It was 10 minutes, and I kind of, I really roused myself.
You pulled yourself back from the brink.
Yeah.
Yeah, it classically, for this genre, the biopic, it tried to do at once too little and too much, giving us a sort of thin soup of Bob Marley.
Thin soup.
But we'll get back to it. Today we're going to talk about One Love, and we'll talk about the Grammys and Usher's, to me, amazing Super Bowl performance. All three of them, right, made me think about the question of legacy. It's a big word, right? And how it's constructed. Which elements of an artist's life get remembered? Which elements kind of fall by the wayside in the retelling? A big question I have is, what do we, broadly construed, all of us who love music, use famous musicians for? And when we're so-called, like, giving them their flowers, what are we saying about ourselves? So that's today on Critics at Large, Musical Legacy and the Art of the Tribute. As we've already kind of teased, we're going to share some thoughts about this Bob Marley biopic. But before we get to that, are there biopics about musicians that you guys actually really love or have shaped how you think about a musician and their work?
I mean, I'm a big fan of Walk the Line, the Johnny Cash biopic with Joaquin Phoenix.
Like keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
It really captured something of the music and made me, it really turned me on to the music also. Like, yes, Johnny Cash is kind of floating around, I think, in the ecosystem, and we all have some sense of what a Johnny Cash song sounds like. Mm-hmm. But it really, like, gave it a specificity to me and made it work.
I mean, what you were saying about specificity is, for me, important when I'm thinking about a successful biopic. And when I was kind of wondering to myself, the biopic, the musical biopic, is so easy to get wrong, I think, and for it to turn kind of one-dimensional.
Why is that? Like, I mean, this is what I want to...
We'll think about it. Yeah, it's a good question, and I want us to talk about that.
Yeah, the pitfall... And the reason that these things often don't work, right, is because I think they are construed often as straightforwardly hagiographic, like that they're functional. Their function is not to make of the pop star a character who's interesting in a narrative, but to sort of account for them and convey their importance, right?
Yeah, it's a person, it's a symbol.
So in the bad biopic, mm-hmm. which might be like the truly like symptomatic, representative, whatever biopic, like we get, every moment has to be freighted with import. Every moment has to be a snippet from the Wikipedia or something that teaches you in a certain way instead of being off to the side, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of mm-hmm. taking you down an alleyway of I don't know, a meandering that we often like in other forms of narrative. The bad biopic doesn't have time for that.
Totally. Yeah, I think there are even further problems. Like, there are even further problems than what you lay out. One of them is that there are certain tropes to the experience of a rock star or a pop star. We know that this person is going to get a deal at some point. They're going to get a record deal. And before they got the record deal, they didn't have one. And they were a nobody. So we got to see them as a nobody. We got to see them getting the deal. These are cliches that are true, but the feeling around them is often rendered exactly the same and flat. Mm-hmm. And then also we're often coming to these movies with a real sense of who this person is as an artist, the persona, and feeling like we know them as a person. I think this is also something that's very specific to music and to musicians, where music is such a connecting force, such a powerful, overpowering force, that when we love a song or we love a band or a performer, we really feel a sense of intimacy and knowledge. And so a music biopic tries to capitalize on that by bringing us even closer to that person, and I think often can seem alienating as a result, because you just think, like, no, that's not quite right. I mean, I want to know what you guys thought about the Bob Marley biopic, because full confession, I did not have a chance to see it. The phrase thin gruel does not make me feel that I missed much.
No, you didn't miss much, which is really too bad, because I want to go back to what you just said about the power of music. I mean, Marley's music is, you know, undisputably powerful and amazing. And I think one thing that is enjoyable about this movie is that they had the music rights, because it was made with the participation of the family. There are many Marleys, you know, that get a credit at mm-hmm. the end. And so, the upshot of that, the positive of that, is that the songs are amazing. And I think what they did is what I believe they have been doing recently in a variety of musical biopics, is they meld Kingsley Benadire's voice with Marley's voice.
Oh, interesting.
I think there are parts where it's like, especially in the live singing footage, either when he's like coming up with a song. Of course, one of the big chintzy tropes of these movies is some sitting on a couch, noodling around on the guitar.
Yeah.
He creates a song that we all know and love out of nowhere.
I mean, literally in those moments, it's like 5 minutes of the movie, he's driving in the car in Kingston with two of his sons, Ziggy and another one of his sons.
Yeah.
They hear some piece of worrying news on the radio about the politics, which actually is also remains quite abstract in the movie. It's like, there were two warring factions, and it's like, okay, this is a little bit, can we get a little bit more meat on this, on this conflict right here, to understand the stakes and like what it means and where Marley stands? And because the whole thing is, kind of propped up on the, you know, the question of political conflict in Jamaica in the late 70s. But in any case, so they're in the car, and he turns off the radio.
Would-be assassins invaded Bob Marley's home and attempted to take the life of the singer and wife.
Don't worry about that. Don't worry about that thing. That every little thing gonna be all right.
You like that one?
Yeah.
And then, of course, proceeds immediately to go into a verse or two
about a thing. And he's like grabbing them because every little thing.
And I was like, oh, they didn't just do that in the first 3 minutes. You know, it's just so kind of, it's like with an anvil on the head at every moment.
Yeah, it's so funny. Like, so again, the director of this film, by the way, his name is Ronaldo Marcus Green. And something that he's trying to fit so much about Marley in. He wants to talk about the politics of Jamaica without talking about the politics of Jamaica. They don't really talk about that. It is really fascinatingly, and this is where I thought the movie could have been really good, about religion. Like Marley was a very pious Rastafarian, and he's always talking about that. He's also always saying, like, God's going to protect me. He talks about God. He's reading stuff about either Haile Selassie, the founder of and sort of object of devotion of Rastafarianism, or he's reading about Marcus Garvey, these like liberationist politics. But again, they're like hinted at, but never. Lashana Lynch, who was Rita Marley, really great performance, but it was the classic wife performance in one of these. You know, she's just there to support him.
That's also
she
what
sings
I got
in the
from
band.
The trailer,
she does this, does that. Has one. There's one moment. There's one passage of it where it's like, oh wow, they're at a party and she's talking to another man. Which then Bob is getting more and more famous on this European tour. He gets jealous, but then she has the chance to unleash on him all of his infidelities and kids outside of their marriage and whatever. It's like the one moment, like, not a hero or whatever.
But that was so brief, right?
Well, this is interesting because, you know, first of all, Rita Marley and Bob Marley, it's very well known that they did not have a particularly faithful marriage. Like, that's not new. That's not like a shock or surprising ground to cover. And even, I'm sorry, just from watching the preview, I know this gives me not a leg to stand on, but I was very
leg
struck.
Enough.
It gives me leg enough to say that I noticed that this portrayal of Rita Marley was very like wide-eyed in awe of the husband's talent and kind of devoted wife. I mean, do you think that that may have something to do with, as Nomi mentioned, like clearly the Marley estate signed off on this? Is there some of that? Because when you talk about the sanding down, Vincent, of Marley's beliefs and the kind of unwillingness to engage with the depth of his beliefs around Rastafarianism or his practices around Rastafarianism, that is also true of kind of the way that most people engage with the image of Bob Marley. Like, he is kind of the ubiquitous star. He is on,
posters.
Yeah, Bob Marley is kind of this adolescent symbol of, I don't really know what, I think a general sense of rebellion and kind of being true to oneself, but at the same time kind of totally—
And smoking weed,
that's for sure. Thank you, Nomi, that's absolutely true. But while smoothing over what Bob Marley was really about. And so it seems interestingly that this movie, just rather than correcting for that, continues that
from
what
that.
You guys
and,
are saying.
And there are moments when, you know, first of all, it's one of those classic movies of like, it has these title cards where it's like Bob Marley, at the beginning, it's like Bob Marley, a pop star and a Jamaican icon. Like, it's always trying to tell you about who he is and where he should stand in your esteem. And there's a moment where, you know, he goes on a European tour. This is the structure of the film, right? Act two is like a long concert footage of him in West Germany, him here, him there.
Well, and he records in London.
Records in London.
Well. Yeah.
And so he's all over Europe, getting more and more famous. And then he comes back for another concert. So sort of act three, I guess, happens back in Jamaica. And there's a moment where he like lands on this plane and comes down the stairs of the plane. And it's like every single person, it looks like every person in Jamaica is waiting for him on the tarmac, waving either the Rastafarian flag or the Jamaican flag, pulling at his clothes. He can barely get into the car. And it's clearly just there to remind you of his stature. The movie is the statue to him, right? The movie is trying to build a great monument in your consciousness. In a minute, can you dance on roller skates? I don't think you can. But do you know who can? Usher Raymond. That and more in just a moment on Critics at Large.
Oh my God. I screamed when the roller skates came out.
Unbelievable.
Screamed.
Hi, I'm Jessica St. Clair, but you can call me Jess if you're nasty.
And I'm Dame Casey Wilson. We are actors, comedians, and podcasters. But above all else, we are self-appointed masters of small talk.
We have written a soon-to-be Nobel Prize-winning audiobook that will surely change the course of history called The Art of Small Talk.
You can listen to the whole thing, start to finish, included with your Spotify Premium membership. Just search for The Art of Small Talk on Spotify.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
You know, we've been talking about the biopic, right, which deals with this question of legacy and how it's built in this really specific, really kind of blunt, often posthumous way. But we have a thing that happens every year that is kind of the beginning of legacy making for big pop acts, which is the Super Bowl halftime show.
Yes.
It's an honor to be asked to do it. It's so in some ways, it acts like a museum retrospective. Right. Here are my greatest hits and here's what I ought to mean to you. Let me sort of reset the stakes of who I am.
Yeah.
This year, the sort of recipient of that honor, and I think the generous giver of some much more than that to us, was Usher. Mm-hmm. Who I feel like I've grown up with. You know, make me want to leave the one I'm with to start a new relationship with you, on and on. These songs I grew up with.
The question of legacy, this is a performer at the height of his powers, but that who has enough of a backlog to sort of fill this, like, absolutely hectic,
you know,
13 and a half minutes or however long it was, with, like, 7,000 hits, right?
That's right.
Featuring, you know, other famous performers who kind of come and kind of garland this main performer and kind of, like, give him this ballast to his importance and his centrality. And I think, Vincent, the idea of, like, we've grown up with this person, you know?
Yeah.
And he deserves this is really strong. There's like, an idea of both nostalgia. This, you know, especially for millennials, I think, growing up with Usher and his back catalog is like a really lived experience, you know? And so there's this idea of a kind of collective memory, right?
That's right.
That's coming together in this moment that's really spectacular in terms of the dancing, in terms of the pizzazz, in terms of, you know, all of the elements involved. It's like a show.
That's right.
The show of shows. But it also, it's like a feather in the cap. It, like, cements a legacy, and it allows a performer to look forward,
right,
as well. Like,
yeah,
where do we go from here?
Right.
Now
look
that we've established this
back.
Fact.
That's right.
Yeah.
Alex, what did you think?
Okay, so to begin with, I always find the Super Bowl halftime show a bizarre situation. It's just, it's a fascinating conceit. The biggest concert of the year is actually an inset into the biggest sporting event of the year. You're performing in a stadium of thousands who've come to see other people. So, and yet you've got to get them rooting for you. And of course, the art of selecting the Super Bowl halftime show performer is someone who can accomplish just that, who everyone who's come to see football will also say, oh, fabulous, it's Usher. Like, I get a little bonus of Usher. And meanwhile, right. like those of us sitting at home, some of us may only be tuning in for the halftime show. I thought, as Nomi is describing, just hearing the hits that have been encoded on our brains. I think someone said, I think it was on Twitter or something, I saw a tweet fly by of some kind that said, you know, oh, this is what the boomers feel like when, like, their people perform at a halftime show. And now there's that feeling of, oh, we're of the age. It's right. now,
enough
there's
years
enough
have
of
passed.
A back catalog. I mean, yeah. people kept remarking on the fact that Usher, who, of course, is in spectacular physical shape, is 45. I thought he delivered and more. First of all, I appreciate the sweat running down that man's face.
Yeah.
He is dancing. He is working. He is singing. He is twirling on his skates. He is re-entering in sneakers. He is, you know, shimmying with Alicia
Keys.
How did he put
the outfit so quickly? Did he change outfits so quickly?
It's an art. I mean, the outfits themselves, of course. You know, my favorite one, I think, was what he wore on the roller skates. A kind of padded shirt that reminded me of what little kids wear when they're dressing up as wrestlers from Halloween, where right. like the abs are superimposed on
right,
top.
Written onto the thing.
Yeah, it's like a superhero. Abs. Yeah, it's like a superhero outfit,
right.
and on a grown man, frankly, is utterly ridiculous in a way that I was like, "You go."
You're the man.
Yeah, I mean, that said, and I think maybe this is where Vincent, you and I may part ways.
Sure.
I never find the energy of a Super Bowl halftime show to be fully satisfying because it's so interstitial.
It's a weird forum. I still care about the Super Bowl performance largely because it's an opportunity to create a memorable moment. You know, I still watch sometimes Prince's Super Bowl performance. He's in that, like, turquoise and orange in 2007, I believe.
Don't it feel good? Only wanna see you, see you. Can I play this guitar?
It decides to rain on Prince, who, you know, who's doing Purple Rain. It's like God saying, I approve of this concert,
yes.
you know. And I'm always excited to see what a performer does in the moment of moments. And in a similar way to how I think about the Super Bowl. Like, I want to see again how amazing Patrick Mahomes is going to be when it all sort of his legacy is on the line. By the way, congratulations to you, Patrick Mahomes, the greatest quarterback of all times. Anybody who cares about this podcast and also cares about sports can argue with me if you'd like, but he's the best ever. Anyway.
Let's get him to listen.
He's the best. Patrick, friend of the show.
If you're out there,
come on the pod.
Come on the pod.
I was just so amazed by him taking that chance, right? Because in the music business, there is a technical term, the legacy act,
mm-hmm.
right? Not the abstraction of what is your legacy, but mm-hmm. there are people, you know, Aerosmith, Guns N' Roses, the Rolling Stones, Billy Joel, who, like, you know, does nothing but sell out Madison Square Garden. Someone who...
Because he's the absolute best.
He's the best. But... on the strength of their hits, on the strength of their past, can tour and tour and tour and without the sort of added burden of coming up with new music. That's what we call a legacy act, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're already stamped. Wherever you show up, there are fans who are going to follow and go with you. And so Usher announcing, I'm one of those, is such an interesting thing to me.
Well, I have a question because... Vincent, I think your point is really interesting about, like, Usher making a case that mm-hmm. he is a legacy artist.
Yeah.
Like, and especially at an interesting moment in his life and career. He's 45. You know, he has a new album out, which he did not play from, you know.
It's not that good.
But
do you think
there's, well, so this is my question. Do you think there's possibly a trade-off between declaring yourself or trying to make a case for yourself as this legacy artist and trying to break new ground musically? Can they be compatible?
It's a good question. And yeah, I think there's a slight incompatibility. Like the more that our culture becomes kind of self-aware and therefore like self-reflexive, like a sort of a retrospective cast, And this isn't just in music. If you listen to sports television, all of it, it's going to be the Chiefs have won their third Super Bowl. What is their legacy? What does this team mean? History is being written right now, and what will the people 20 years from now say is mm-hmm. what that question really means. Mm-hmm. What trying to forecast, what is LeBron James's legacy? We ask this question a lot, and I think it's because of like the rise of digital media and how easy it is for us to look back, how easy it is for us to like immediately go listen to every single Joni Mitchell album and develop ideas about them as if we lived in the past, as if we lived in the time of their come up. So it's like now these artists are obsessed, I think, with their own legacy. It's not just us looking back at Bob Marley, who was dead. It's people trying to erect these statues of themselves as they are living. And I do think that there is a trade-off there. In a minute, we'll talk about Jay-Z's big speech at the Grammys and more.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then, I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
I do want to mention this issue of legacy around the Grammys, which I think this year were about legacy.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that you made me think of, Vincent, when you were talking before about making a case, was Taylor Swift, who I think maybe is the definition of the artist who's obviously a legacy artist, but who can't, like, who's just marching forward in her world domination. Like, of course, famously at this Grammys, she was like, and guess what? My new album's coming. So, yep.
When she won her first award, she used that occasion to.
Yes.
And, you know, in the Grammys as well, there was the moment when Taylor Swift pulled Lana Del Rey up to the stage. Mm-hmm. When she got her.
She won Album of the Year.
She won Album of the Year.
Fourth time, which makes her the most. The person who's won that the most.
Winningest, yeah, Album of the Year artist ever. And she pulled Lana on the stage to sort of give her props and said about Lana Del Rey, she's a legacy artist. She said those words.
She did.
Yeah, which I thought was really interesting, especially vis-a-vis what is considered a legacy artist.
I think she was trying to say, this is someone, listen, pay attention to her now. Because she's going to be one of these people in the future who we talk about in totally hollowed tones. And I think she's one of those people who's working at her peak right now. So pay attention as it's happening.
Right, right.
So there's one moment at the Grammys that feels especially worth mentioning. This is Jay-Z accepting the Dr. Dre Global Impact Award.
We're here. But then, 98, I took a page out of their book. I was nominated for the Best Rap Album. And DMX had dropped two albums that year. They both were number one. Shout out to DMX. And he wasn't nominated at all. So I boycotted and I watched the Grammys. I'm just saying, we want y'all to get it right. We love y'all. We love y'all. We love y'all. We want y'all to get it right. At least get it close to right. And obviously it's subjective. Y'all don't gotta clap at everything. Obviously, it's subjective because.
And he's accepting this award and he starts talking about Beyonce. He's pointing out that she has more Grammys than anyone as of last year, but she's never won Album of the Year.
But, you know, some things, you know, I don't want to embarrass this young lady, but she has more Grammys than everyone and never won Album of the Year. So even by your own metrics, that doesn't work. Think about that. The most Grammys, never won Album of the Year. That doesn't work. You know, some of you gonna go home tonight and feel like.
So, okay. To my mind, a very annoying and somewhat distasteful speech. And we can talk about that. I may be in the minority there. But it does put forward this idea of what it means to be an artist. Until they give you the accolades that you think you deserve.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this sort of living in the present with all a preordained sense of retrospection. Here's how I want to be seen. It's really interesting. Jay-Z, of course, is complaining about when he says this young lady, he's talking about his wife, Beyonce.
Who's 42, let's be clear.
Who's 42 years old. Young at heart, amazing. But she's won the most Grammys in history as of last year, has not won Album of the Year. And the worry, the anxiety is, will history therefore, it's kind of pragmatic. It's like if people are looking at this sort of, I don't know, quantitatively, when we look back in the books, who won the most Album of the Year, whatever, will they give her the due that she so obviously deserves as we have lived, you know, lived the Beyonce experience? But I don't know. How do artists' self-conceptions and self-making and sort of self-icon making interact with our own uses of their celebrity and their identity?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like two different categories to me, or two different. I mean, this speech is, you know, as you kind of pointed out, Vincent, is obsessed with data.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Obsessed with numbers, obsessed with tallying, obsessed with calculating. And I can see why, obviously. I mean, it's kind of obvious why that has its own import. Especially if, as Jay-Z points out, you have come from the outside, then the history is pretty short, relatively speaking, for Black musicians and you know, the type of, like, institutional accolades that they have been getting. So I get that. But when we think about, for the listeners, what it means for a musician to be meaningful, you know, or to be a legacy musician in the heart of a listener. It's like, is that what we really care about? Certainly it's not what I care about, but I don't know. I mean, maybe others, you know, it sounds to me more kind of closer to the type of tallying that happens in kind of like fan culture right now, which, yeah, I don't really totally understand. Kind of like,
right,
how could you not give this to her? How could you give this to him and not to him? You know, the sort of constant kind of like combativeness based on these supposedly objective metrics, which even Jay-Z notes are not really objective, you know, can't be objective.
Right.
One thing I find kind of touching in it is like Jay-Z going back into his, like, imagining kind of a young, brash Jay-Z who, like, the attitude is all like, hey, we're coming through now. You know, we're hip hop, we're rap. Like, you guys can't handle it. You guys don't want to, like, put DMX up for Album of the Year. Well, go, you know, fuck off.
Right.
But then also watching it in his hotel room because you can't get rid of the aura and still the sense of what it means. But, like, you know, what about, if I may just call back to the year 1863, what about the Salon des Refusés? You know, a bunch of, like, impressionist painters, right, are saying to the official French salon, oh, I'm sorry, you want us to put, like, you know, you want us to put Venus and Cupid up forever and, like, you know, show this super hyper-realist painting of mythic and historical subjects? Well, we're actually a little more interested in how light looks when it hits water.
That's right.
So that's where we're at right now. And you don't want to show that on your official walls? Well, we're going to create our own system because we are not going to wait for you to catch up to us. And you will. And if you don't, fuck you. You know, we're where we're at. So it's so interesting that, like, the potential for this kind of, you know, idea of well, we're working outside the system, you better come around. There's something really unstable in that relationship between the rebels who now are inside and no one is more inside than Jay-Z. I mean,
that's right.
It just seems, to want the very official, the kind of,
that's right.
You know, frankly, lamest channels to come recognize you. That gives the Grammys more power. Like, this critique of the Grammys to me gives them way more power.
It's interesting. So I'll qualify in two ways why, you know, on some level I shouldn't be annoyed by this. One is, okay, we're kind of in the second generation of, you know, big globalized commercial pop music, which means that today's artists have a whole century, give or take, of, again, data as to what did the people before me who we still remember do, what accolades did they garner, what was their path, and how can I on some level replicate that? You know, when we talk about Taylor Swift, for example, a lot of what we say is that she's very savvy. Mm-hmm. You know, that mm-hmm. on the level of public relations, on the level of marketing, image making, that she has, by studying the Beatles, by studying Michael Jackson, whoever you want to talk about, is following on some level a template that leads to mega stardom, right? Fine. I will note, though, that what that does is take away the element of us. It's like, I don't want to leave my legacy in the hand of listeners, for goodness sake. I need to, you know, make a certain number of institutional structural moves that put me where I want to be after I'm dead. The other thing is that I think Jay-Z is trying to talk about, you know, when he says, get it right. He's trying to talk about the underrepresentation of Black music and specifically hip hop. Like this year, Killer Mike, a great rapper, won Rap Album of the Year. I love his album, Michael. That award was, again, not televised.
Right.
So to the extent he's making a structural argument about race and genre and the way companies make money off of hip hop, but then do not reflect it in the wider culture. OK, fine. But I will note that the way that he is doing that is by talking about his billionaire wife, who he wants us to feel some sort of pity for because she hasn't gotten the one, you know, spoke in this crown. Whereas, of course, what we think of, this is totally your point about the Impressionists and other art movements. What we like about artists is that they don't care about this stuff, right? That they are on some level unsullied.
Or they give the impression of not caring, which maybe is maybe another career move.
Yeah, right.
Like, you know, maybe Monet or whatever and Manet are sitting watching the televised Salon and they're just like, you know, eating a burger in a hotel room.
Right.
Just like, God damn it. Like, you know, all right, they're going for those guys with the little brush strokes again.
Yeah. It's this thing, though, about like they were what's interesting about those people is that they are foregoing. They're trusting that my art will enshrine me. At some level, someone much later will pick up on this and it will matter. Whereas today's artists often come across to me, pop musicians, the big whatever market level pop musicians, I won't make a general statement, strike me as control freaks. It's like
absolutely
the biopic, for example, that just to go back to this example of One Love, right? Just as the biopic tells you what you ought to think, tries to control not just your sort of, you know, narrative enjoyment, but your sort of legacy, your Mount Rushmore awareness of a person. Today's artists seem often to want to do that in real time. And it actually has a market corollary because we're in the era of the, you know, the authorized biopic. It's like always, you know, I want to put forward my own hagiography so that I can be in control of how you think of me later on.
Yeah,
and it seems to me self-defeating and also ungenerous to audiences.
Yeah, especially if it's if you're not willing to reveal, if you're interested, as you said about Jay-Z, Alex, in the sort of white bread acceptance, you're going to construct to yourself a kind of monument that fits that definition. And that's just not interesting. Like, where's the juice? You know what I mean? And whatever happened to, like, I mean, once again, I'm going to, like, bring back my Gen X, you know, identification. It's like, didn't we have a moment where we weren't supposed to care about this kind of thing? You know, like, weren't we supposed to, like, post Nirvana, weren't we supposed to think that sort of like these corporate institutions suck? But that has passed.
You know? And I just want to say that I'm warring with my own feelings about the Jay-Z speech in part because like for like fans hold people to impossible standards all the time. And maybe one impossible standard is just we'll stay outside the system and reject the system. And
no, of course.
So, you know, yeah, and that seems very unfair to say, no, you shouldn't want the greatest global marker of success. You should, you know, be content to be outside the thing. But yeah, Vincent, I think you're exactly right about this. Everything is shaping me. No one is. I mean, Taylor Swift and Beyonce are the two exemplars of this.
Yeah.
I mean, another thing that happened at the Super Bowl is that Beyonce released two new songs. I think I saw someone on Twitter compare it to being the bridesmaid who's proposed to at the wedding, like just kind of totally overshadowing Usher. You know, I might mention that she announced them in a Verizon ad. All I could think about while watching the ad was how much money Verizon must be paying to get this honor. But like, isn't the, I mean, not to be so pathetically building block basic, isn't the best builder of legacy to keep making good, interesting music and changing and reshaping? I mean, right? So
yeah,
it's
– but of course, that's less reliably, quote unquote, objective than getting these like institutional accolades, right? I mean, we can – which brings us, yeah, maybe to another question of the sort of the legacy of the heart. You know what I mean? Rather than the legacy kind of writ large in corporate terms or in, you know, institutional terms, whatever you want to call it, in metrics.
Yeah.
The legacy of the heart, my friends, you know, whatever that might mean.
Well,
to
I think
us.
It means that people are still listening to your music and finding it wonderful and relevant for years. You know, a number of astonishing to me performances at this year's Grammys were about a deeper, truer sense of legacy, the kind of legacy that comes when people just really love your music and it means so much to them. Mm-hmm. And it's not about brand building. It's about having lived it. And I'm talking about Tracy Chapman and Joni Mitchell herself performing Both Sides Now, sitting regally with a cane, her voice several octaves lower than
That's
it was
right.
at her peak, essentially doing a cover of her song because she's a different person than she was when she wrote it.
A different singer.
Those performances were amazing. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of talk about why Tracy Chapman in particular moved people so much. And I'd love to hear your guys' thoughts on this. Performing Fast Car with Luke Combs, who's covered it and who brought that song back into the charts this year. There's something so special about Tracy Chapman's voice that is hard to put into words. But I think the purity of the performance, like, she's wearing jeans, she's wearing a button-down shirt, she doesn't have makeup on.
You got a fast car, I want a ticket to anywhere. Maybe we make a deal, maybe together we can get somewhere. Any place is better, starting from zero, got nothing to lose. Maybe we'll make something, be myself, I got nothing to prove.
I think she actually like reminded people of what music can do and is about when you remove some of the fanfare around it.
Yeah.
It was like the exact opposite of the halftime show, and they both have their place.
I got a plan inside of here, been working at the convenience store. Managed to save just a little bit of money. Won't have to drive too far.
And I think crucially it's not about icons as personalities. It's about not the durability of an image, but the durability of an artwork. Like Fast Car, the reason it's amazing is that Luke Combs, you know, a country singer, a kind of bard of working class white America, let's say, can sing Fast Car, which is about someone in a bad situation loving someone else and together hoping, dreaming for more.
I remember when we were driving, coming in your car, speed so fast, I felt like I was wrong. City lights lay out before us.
That idea is durable, that can live in one moment in a black woman's body and it can live in another moment in a white man's body. And it, you know, the memory doesn't inhere in a personality, but in a true and in a work of art, in the specificity of a work of art. Beyond the biopic, beyond the Grammy, whatever, is something that is, to your point about metrics, Nomi, like unquantifiable, which is the thrill of discovery. The true, you know, and some on some levels.
Or the thrill of re-listening.
Or re-listening, yeah. Rediscovery. You know, just somebody, I don't know if you guys have seen these videos. It's like these two black kids, like, listening to old songs that they've never heard.
Of course. What are their names again? Oh, yeah. Of course I know this.
I forgot their names. But the
famous one of them listening to...
In the Air Tonight.
Yes,
Phil
In the Air
Collins.
Tonight.
And, like, they hear that, like, ba-bum, ba-dum, ba-bum, ba-dum,
which comes, like, three-quarters of the way into the song.
Yeah, and they're like, holy shit! And it's like, and that is timeless, and it cannot be easily, like, transmuted into... money or accolades or whatever, but it's like that's the heart of it. Like someone picks it up and passes it like a baton to the next generation.
I can see it now with my daughter who's listening to like music that I listened to in the 90s and is like, you know, discovering like Nirvana.
Yeah, and she probably feels it as a statement of rebellion against you to some degree, which honestly, if it's doing its job, she should.
Yeah.
Even though I mean, you're handing it directly to her.
Yeah, absolutely.
This has been Critics at Large. Our senior producer is Rhiannon Corby, and Alex Barish is our consulting editor. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Condé Nast's head of global audio is Chris Bannon. Alexis Quadrado composed our theme music, and we had engineering help today from Jake Loomis, with mixing by Mike Kutchman. You can find every episode of Critics at Large at newyorker.com/critics, and you can email us at themail@newyorker.com. with the subject line, Critics. Critics at Large is, by the way, taking a break next week, but we'll be back in your feed the week after that. Have a great long weekend.
Hi, I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor of The New Yorker and host of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast. On the podcast, I ask a great contemporary writer to select a favorite story from the magazine's almost 100-year archive to read and discuss. Together, we delve into the story, exploring its themes, its style, and what makes fiction work. You can listen to authors like Otessa Moshfegh talk about why we write.
Story, or attaching a story or creating a story, is this inclination that we all have to stop spinning.
And you can hear writers like George Saunders discuss the nature of storytelling.
On the first read, you accept these things as descriptions and they make you see the scene, but every line is a chance to inflect the reader's mind.
You'll discover new favorite authors and read old favorites in new ways. Episodes of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast are released on the first of every month. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.